A new iPhone update sends notifications to users letting them know how much time they spend on their phones in a week. It's called screen time, and even though it's responding to a plea for help with screen overload, it has not been well received. A CNN politics editor is one of the many iPhone users who tweeted her dismay. iPhone's screen time function sucks, she says. You created this world. You do not get to shame me for living in it. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And today we're not wagging our fingers. We're looking at ourselves. What's wrong with us? Why can't we stop looking at our phones? Call 816-235-2888 with confessions, observations, solutions, or maybe a defense of your smartphone obsession. If you dare. 816-235-2888. I want to start with Ian Schur. He wrote an article about his own screen addiction and his fear that it might be hurting his 2-year-old son. It's called Your Kids Hate Your Smartphone Addiction. Ian, good morning.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm okay. I'm talking to you from my phone, of course.
Yeah, but that means you're not looking at it.
That's true.
So what inspired this article?
You know, I have been struggling with this issue really since I can remember. I mean, when I first started dating my now wife, we had a lot of conversations about how much I was using my phone. The iPhone came out. It kind of drove that all into overload. And then my son came along 2 years ago, and the conversation kind of shifted to what kind of model do we want to present to him about how you're supposed to behave and handle these things? And are we being appropriate parents when we're looking at our phone? And I really wanted to dig into this because it's very easy to feel bad about it and just start kind of beating yourself up.
And sneaking glances, as you describe.
Sneaking glances, absolutely. Because, you know, we have this culture that's very anti-screen time. And look, I certainly have
problems. But also that expects you to respond to everything coming to you through your phone at all times.
Yes, exactly, right? I mean, there are a number of instances. One, probably the most egregious, sneaking a look at an alert during a religious service. But, you know, this is normal behavior for a lot of people. So I wanted to figure out, okay, how serious is this? Is there any research out there? And what I found is that there's a growing body of research that's showing that parents' phone addictions actually do hurt their kids. They make them feel unimportant, sad, mad, angry, lonely. One study that really hit me was that they actually looked at parents and caregivers who were on their phones in a fast food restaurant. So think about this. The parents and the kids are eating. So they're doing another activity. The parents pull out their phone and the kids still bid for attention and start behaving poorly because the parents are on the phone, even though everyone's eating. So it's a problem that continues to be going on.
You cite some harrowing statistics in this article. According to a data analytics firm called Flurry, the average American spends about 5 hours a day on a mobile device. And you say that number skews even higher for young adults, that nearly 40% of people between 18 and 29 are online almost constantly, according to the Pew Research Center, and that 9 times out of 10 they're on a mobile device. This information does bother me, and we can talk about why, but it doesn't actually surprise me. Does it surprise you?
Not at all. I mean, this is part of the culture that we live in now. And if you look at it, there are efforts underway in other places to try and kind of change the culture around our phones, right? For example, in France, they actually passed a law where people are allowed to shut off their work devices, right, their work email, and they can't be penalized after work. That is something that's like alien in this country. So there are, you know, there is a kind of a culture that we built up in this country, whether we wanted to or not, where our phones are just constantly in our hands at a 45-degree angle, and we're always looking at them. And that is something that is concerning. And then it affects things like our relationships and our parenting and all these other things.
You know, it's interesting. I also have a 2-year-old, and I have a self-determined rule of not looking at my phone in front of him. And if I have a circumstance where I need to look at it, I explain to him what I'm doing so that it's not just sort of this taking mom away, like, mystery. But it's interesting that during the time I'm not looking at my phone, which is really just like after work and before his very early bedtime, it's very frustrating to the people in my life that I'm not responding to them. And that is a piece of this.
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting. I think part of that, it depends on kind of the set expectations you set, right? And for me, you know, I have partially through my behavior set an expectation that people know I'm ultra responsive. And I've created this hole for myself, right, where I have to be ultra responsive. And having, you know, kind of setting new boundaries is hard. But one of the things that, you know, I spoke to a lot of child development experts as part of the story for CNET. And one of the things they always told me was that I need to make sure that I'm careful about my boundaries. It can't be extreme, right? It's not fair to expect me to just quit the phone cold turkey whenever I'm around him. But if I set appropriate boundaries for him, for me, in my life, I can make it work. And I think that's what's important, right? The extremes never do.
So talk a little bit about, you talked to experts, you did two things. You talked to experts about why you couldn't just control this on your own. And then you also talked about advice for setting boundaries. Let's start with that first part. Why are we all addicts?
Well, a lot of this actually comes down to just the way our brains work. You know, when you get an alert, it kicks off this little dopamine reaction, right? Which is the same thing that causes us to seek out food and drugs and, you know, all sorts of other stuff. It leads to addictive behavior. And so dopamine actually stimulates and rewards us when it comes on an unpredictable schedule, which is exactly what phone alerts are, right? They come in all the time. So this means that there's constantly kind of your brain is being besieged by these things that it really wants. It wants these distractions. It wants these little kicks of interest. And that's part of why we all struggle with this, whether or not we're parents. And so part of what the recommendations were to make it better were actually to try and make sure that I am thinking about how am I being appropriate to my son. And what that means is stuff like, for example, if I have an alert that comes in on my phone and I have to look at it, just like you, telling him what I'm doing, explaining what I'm doing is a really good behavior, because then he doesn't think I'm just ignoring him, which, look, for a kid who doesn't understand what this metal slab in your hand is, that's really important. The other thing that was recommended by Dr. Harvey Karp, who's kind of the, you know, the Dr. Spock of our era, one of the things he recommended was that you actually set a timer. One person actually recommended I get a sand timer that's like a minute sand timer that the kid can control. And when the sand timer runs out, I have to go back to paying attention. And that way they have a sense of time and attention and patience that goes along with this whole exercise for you and me.
Well, so forgetting the impact on your child, what has been the impact on you and your own quality of life now that you have set boundaries? Is it different?
Well, to be honest, I struggle. And I even though, you know, I've written this story and, you know, I started work on this in May. So I've been thinking about this a lot. I still struggle with it. And I think that it's going to be something that really this generation of parents is going to struggle with, because we grew up in this era where it was kind of, we weren't thinking about these things, and we've kind of created these addictions for ourselves for these alerts, and it's going to be a constant struggle. And what's interesting is I hear about kids today who are like 5 to 8, and a lot of them are rejecting technology the way we use it. They are trying to set boundaries because they don't like what's going on. And they're kind of reacting to how we are. So I think it's going to be a constant struggle for you and me. But, you know, it's something that I do think about a lot. And I try, you know, the big thing was Harvey Karp told me, look, don't beat yourself up. It's not fair. One of the stats that he gave me that just blew my mind is that there's this thing called the American Time Use Survey. It's something the Department of Labor has been doing for like 50 or 60 years. It's about how people use their time. And one of the stats that comes out of that is that they found that we actually spend more time just focused on parenting our kids today than housewives alone did during the 1960s. And part of that is because a lot of things. We've isolated our families. We don't actually have as many people helping us parent as they did back 50, 60 years ago. But the result of that is that we need to be able to give ourselves a little bit of time on our own and respect that we need to do that, but also make sure we're also taking care of our kids. And that's a very hard thing to do.
Well, you know, I mean, what actually bothers me about my own phone use, and I say this in spite of other people frequently calling me a Luddite, it bothers me to think about what I am not doing instead. It's not that I feel bad about what I'm doing on my phone. It's that I remember how I used free time in the past, speaking of how we use our time. And
right.
I marvel that these little gadgets can even begin to compete with, like, baking bread, you know?
Yeah, no, totally. And, you know, I think that might be, I'm really curious to see what the generation growing up now is going to be like in 10 or 15 years, because there are always these reactions that happen. And it may be that there's a push toward that. I think also, you know, Apple and Google are not dumb. This whole screen time feature that you mentioned at the top of the show, that is something that's a reaction to a growing trend. This conversation is not happening in a vacuum. There's a lot of conversation about how much we're using our phones. And I think it started with the texting and driving conversation and our obsession with even having to do that and place ourselves in danger. Now it's moving to how is it affecting our relationships and our kids. And I think that as that continues, there's going to be a reaction. If Apple and Google don't look like they're on it, they're going to start looking like the villains in all of this.
So what do you think... what do you think would be some good advice for the companies themselves? Like, if people don't like the screen time function, what would your advice as someone who wants help be to, like, how can the companies who put these things in our hands help us regulate them so that we don't hate them eventually?
Yeah, I think that part of it is actually going to be on you and me and a lot of other people. It's how many of these alerts do we sign up for? How often are we putting ourselves in this situation where we are allowing ourselves to get these dopamine kicks? A lot of it is actually going to come from you and me. But there are things that these companies can do. One of them is to very aggressively offer tools to be able to silence these notifications, to control them so that, you know, you say, look, you know, if I'm at home, for example, if my location, my phone notices I'm at home, don't send me notifications or stuff like that. There are all these types of features that they could offer. And look, it's on you and me to set them up and learn how they work and all of that.
But yeah, I set up the thing where my phone will not let me get a call if I'm driving. And but even if I'm in someone else's moving car, it admonishes me.
Right. And that's part of the problem is that these features are not smart enough yet. Right. And what happens is that if it doesn't work perfectly for you, you're going to give up on it, which is how all of us would feel. So that's part of where these companies really need to work and refine. But, you know, I've talked to Apple and I've talked to Google, and both of them have told me that they understand that this is something people are anxious about and they want to offer solutions. Now, you may see that as cold comfort, considering they're also selling us the drug in the first place, but at least they see the problem.
Well, I'm Gina Kaufman. We are talking about smartphone addiction, and we will get to your calls in a minute. 816-235-2888 with your story, your solutions, or maybe your embrace of the whole situation. This is KCUR Central Standard, and do not ditch this conversation for a game on your phone. We've still got thoughts from a local activist keeping cell phones out of classrooms and a whole conversation about how circadian rhythm works. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about smartphone addiction. We're taking calls, offering confessions of your problems, solutions for setting boundaries. And you know who I'd also really love to hear from? People who don't use smartphones at all. How does that work for you in today's world? 816-235-2888. Ian Schur is my guest. And Ian, you wrote this article, Your Kids Hate Your Smartphone Addiction. And you know what I like about the title? It flips the conversation we usually have on its head. We talk so much about how to keep our kids from being obsessed with screens and, you know, not interested in flesh and blood humans around them. But we do not acknowledge that our own behavior is the problem.
Yeah, that is exactly why I wrote this story, is that I have been hearing since way before we had our kid about these concerns about screen time for kids. And there was never really much conversation about the adults in the room. And it felt like every time I was at a party or I was at a dinner, all the adults were on their phones and they were kind of going along. But then they'd suddenly admonish the kids, don't be on your iPad. And it's felt very weird to me. And so part of our coverage at CNET, we've really tried to look at, how is this stuff changing the culture of adults using technology, and then how is that impacting kids? Because I feel like we need to remember that all of this parenting stuff is a two-way street. It's not just about how the kids are behaving, and it's a really important conversation. Mm-hmm.
Let's bring in someone who has done work on kids and screens here in Kansas City, because what works and what doesn't for kids might be worth considering for ourselves. Tracy Foster, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You are the co-founder of a company known as START. That's an acronym for Stand Together and Rethink Technology. What is that?
Yeah, so what it is it's a grassroots movement of parents who started exactly as Ian and you are saying, by thinking, wow, I'm seeing what's happening with my kids. I'm seeing the pressures that we're getting to at earlier and earlier ages, give them devices and feel like they're going to miss out in the global society and economy if they're not constantly using devices. And we started to say, it's almost
or like, words with friends.
Yes, exactly. And it's almost like we just kind of fell into that. And we realized, is that really what we think life is about and what we think we want for our kids? So we started as just a conversation of saying, how do we feel about this? It was 10 parents here in Kansas City on a closed Facebook group, which we laugh at the irony of that. Yes, technology can support our values. But that closed Facebook group grew from 10 parents to over 3,000 just through word of mouth of other parents saying,
and local, all local?
All local. I mean, we have a few people from other cities, but representing more than 70 schools across our metro. And so we really started looking at the child angle, but absolutely agree with exactly what Ian was sharing and you're sharing about the fact that parents come to the table because they all see the problem and challenges that their kiddos are facing. But that really, when we start to work with them, that it actually has to start with us. We're the leaders in our families.
Was there a moment in your own life that really sort of like caused that light bulb to go on for you?
Yeah. Well, 7 years ago, when I was pregnant with my first child, I was doing a project for work with one of the largest toy companies in the world. And as part of that, we were really reading about and understanding and hearing their beautiful perspective about the power of play and how important it is for social, emotional development, for relational connection, for cognitive development, for all sorts of things, the power of building with blocks or playing with a little farm and animals. It's actually a huge piece of development. And so I was very visibly pregnant. And after one of these meetings, their head of research pulled me aside and just said, I'm so glad that you're in this meeting and hearing this, because I believe that our industry is at a moral impasse. And when I see what new parents are seeking out in the marketplace in terms of, oh, this toy comes with an app and I'm just going to get my kiddo onto the device, I just want to tell you, please, please focus on the power of play with your kid that's about to be born.
So what do you do with the schools and with parents in particular?
Yeah. So START right now is working in the suburbs and is convening parents at a school level to talk about technology. And we really start by our kind of tip of the spear is saying technology with kids. But then we invite parents into a three-part conversation. So parents are committing a lot of time, for busy parents, to come to our session 3 different weeks for 90 minutes a week. But what we do is we pull them in and we talk to them about three things. First, we help them consider and understand what are some of the side effects that we're seeing in our community related to technology. Then we help them think about how can we create a plan to really give a roadmap of how we can work to make some of those small changes that we've been talking about. And then third, how should we think about connection and how can we make sure that we're connecting with our kids offline, but also how can we be connecting with our kids online? Because that's a reality and we don't want to be pushing ourselves out of their world in that way.
Okay, well, we're going to hear very shortly some of the specifics on this, but I want to take some of our calls at 816-235-2888. Let's talk to Murad calling us from Independence. Hi, Murad.
Hey, good morning. I really appreciate the conversation. One of my experiences is sitting in a room with my daughters and their mom, and everyone's on the phone. We're supposed to be watching a television show, a movie. And I'm saying to them, okay, you have to be able to put the phone down. So personally, I use the phone like the newspaper. So if I read the alert, I read it, I put it down. If I get messages from the news media, I read the story, I put it down. I don't allow myself to stay on it. I use an earpiece so I don't have to hold the phone. And I think that helps me from just focusing on the phone itself.
What does that allow you in your life, do you feel? I mean, does it affect other things in your life besides just phone consumption?
Well, absolutely, because I was a hands-on father, so it meant something to me to have discussions with them. If I was going to show them how to do something in the house, I actually showed them hands-on. They didn't just get the words from me, here and the instructions, here, do this. No, I would actually show them how it worked. Using the earpiece allows me the freedom to move about and do things. So if I get a call, I can still talk to you, as in now, I'm getting ready to go do something, but I can move around without holding onto that phone. But then there's the safety side of this. If you're just focusing on your phone, you're in the public, you're not really paying attention to the things around you. One of the things I would tell my children, no matter where you go, always pay attention to the route you take. So if something happens, you know how to get back home.
Yeah, and that's maybe worth a whole nother discussion. Do we still know how to navigate a place with our own brains and something that, yeah. Do we still know where we are most of the time? Maybe not. Maybe we've outsourced that to our phones. So, Ian, what are you hearing in this based on what you've talked about? Like, just this aspect of sort of the physical, that we are physically consumed by our phones, not just mentally. So like the idea of getting up and showing something. This is interesting to me because I did read an article once about how with parenting and phones specifically, our parents were also busy in front of us. But when you're interacting with the physical world, you see what they're doing. There's some transparency in it. And you're learning skills, like you're learning how to use an address book. You're learning to read the paper. Everything looks the same on a phone.
That's very true. And to a kid, especially not looking at the phone, all they see is a metal slab with glass on top that you're tapping at, right? They don't know what's going on, which is part of why the child development experts said that bringing them in and narrating what you're doing is incredibly important if you need to use a device in front of them. So, you know, and that actually has an educational aspect, right? They're learning how these things work. Eventually, they're going to want to use them on their own, and they'll have an easier time transitioning to that. So those are all very key. But the other thing I kept hearing was that this is about time management, right? It's about thinking about how much time am I spending on this device and being actively thinking about that. And I think that as people think about these things and they say, okay, I'm going to give myself, you know, I set myself a minute timer on my phone, and the minute that goes beep, I have to get off of it. Doing stuff like that and not just passively consuming it, I think changes the way that we have a relationship with this stuff and can help to kind of shape this conversation.
Let's talk to Drew in Kansas City, Kansas. Hi, Drew.
Hello. Good morning.
What do you want to share?
Well, I'm not necessarily the targeted demographic that you were asking for earlier. I do have a smartphone. I use it every day.
Oh, no. We're interested in your story.
Well, so I am, I guess you'd call me a millennial, and I have noticed that in my generation specifically, the effect that smartphones have had on us, it's not simply just, like the other caller said, not knowing where we are, not knowing how to get back from the route we've taken, but it's kind of what the guest that you have on spoke on earlier about the dopamine receptors and how that easily formulates an addiction. And addictive properties, as you know, a lot of psychologists have talked about, do have the capacity to create a type of psychosis, you know, where you are experiencing delusions, but now we're experiencing them in mass. So we're at the point now where we have these psychosis machines in our hands. And at least people in my generation, the way that we're coping with it is using overabundance of irony and sarcasm to denote our circumstances.
Wait. Okay, I need you to explain this a little bit more. When you say psychosis machines, in what way are we can you describe the psychosis we're experiencing en masse, as you put it?
Yes. So what I mean is we are experiencing a sense of isolation, a delusion of isolation through engagement through indirect means. So we in one sense, we feel completely isolated. In the next moment, we also feel as though we're being immersed by an overabundance of information and overabundance of notifications. This kind of causes, a psychosis of sorts, not necessarily purely pathological, but in some ways it is.
Okay.
To the point where it is a constant struggle.
Let's hear Ian's response to this. Ian, this idea of being in contact but not connected.
Mm-hmm. It's actually really fascinating. You know, as I brought up, Dr. Harvey Karp, who's kind of the Dr. Spock of this generation, he's very focused on this idea of how isolated we all are. And it's something that's been coming up a lot, which is that as we are parenting this next generation of parents and the millennials who really waited a long time to become parents because of the recession and all sorts of other things are now starting to have kids. And they're learning that they don't have as much support because they've isolated each other and they don't have the group thing. For example, Dr. Karp was talking to me about how we all remember we've seen on television or we've heard the stories about the parents on Sunday morning who were reading the newspaper, right? And the kids were playing in the other room and everything was fine. A lot of us, that feels like an alien thing. We can't imagine being able to do our own thing on a Sunday. And part of the reason that was possible was not because we didn't have our phones or whatever else. It was because we had more help. Our families were more involved. We had more friends who were over more often. There were more
kids. But was
kids
that because we were not texting with them? We were actually gathering?
You know, it's actually a very hard thing to nail down. There's a lot of research going on right now to try and figure out how did we isolate each other so much? Because there's other data out there, for example, that we are actually less mobile today. We're unwilling to move for a job and stuff like that than we were 60 years ago. So you would think, well, maybe we're moving away for our families more, and that's what's doing it. But the opposite is true. So there's something going on in this culture that no one's really nailed down yet, that everyone's kind of circling, including in this conversation, trying to figure out why we've isolated each other so much, and also, as a result, why we kind of bid for the phone as a way to kind of at least get out to the real world and get away from this extra time that we're spending parenting.
This is super depressing. Tracy Foster, I want to turn back to you because, the parents and families you work with, they're working with you voluntarily, mm-hmm. and they're giving of their time. They're they're invested in having a healthier relationship with technology. Have you thought about trying to reach a less voluntary audience? And what do you suppose that might be like?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we started by really thinking about gathering these parents and communities. But then what we heard from the people who we were serving was we need more. And we thought about the fact that it was essentially becoming like a little bit of a mountaintop experience just for a few. And then they were going back out into the world and not necessarily having it reinforced by others or by other venues. We and our kids have our tech norms. We talk a lot about creating new norms for our community. They're influenced by so many different things, our schools, our families, our daycare, our jobs, our everywhere we touch. So what's really powerful about here in Kansas City with those 3,000 people, and it's more now, is that it's not just about those training sessions. We believe that's kind of the mile deep, inch wide, people really getting a lot of training and equipping. But we're actually working with people across the community, municipal leaders, business leaders, education sector leaders, so many people to say, hey, this takes a village, not just the way Ian was talking about it in terms of a village of raising your kids that way, but it also takes a village to set what those norms are in a community.
So what interests me about your work thinking about schools is that you have ended up not actually advocating for banning cell phones at school altogether, which is interesting to me because that's sort of the popular rallying cry.
Well, I would say we are very supportive of schools and encourage schools to reduce bring your own devices to school. So that is something that causes a lot of tension if kids are on their own devices inside of a school using their cellular access to access who knows what and being distracted from curriculum. It's much better if the child is on a school-provided device that hopefully has solid filters and controls, which several of the school districts are actively thinking about. But it is true that we are not trying to say there's a line in the sand, you need to just withhold technology from your kids until a certain age or this or that. We compare it much more to the process of driving driving. So we don't take a kid and say, congratulations, you're 16. Here's your present. It's car keys. Go out and have fun and try to stay safe. You know, we actually are training our kids how to handle driving in a proper way from the time that they're very young. I have two kids, 3 and 7, and they're asking me all the time about my driving. They're learning through the modeling of riding in the back seat, similar to what you and Ian were sharing. But then what also typically would you'd have for driving that we're just lacking for technology. So right now my kids are also learning about technology. They're learning about technology by how I'm interacting with it, even though they don't have devices of their own. They're learning, what should I give my attention to? How should I handle this? How can I use devices with the narrating and things that you said? But we're also eager to start to build out an actual kind of learner's permit phase that says, what does it look like to give kids increasing levels of responsibility? Because we're not just going to do all or nothing, but how can we give them the technology equivalent of starting in a parking lot, which is a very safe place with a parent or other adult who can help train them on how to take incremental steps and grow their responsibility accordingly in a safer, more measured way?
If you were to leave us with one lesson to be learned from what works and what doesn't work for kids, like lessons mm-hmm. that we can use for our own selves, what mm-hmm. would it be?
Well, my biggest lesson of what works for kids is that we have to start by showing it with ourselves. So if we're being hypocritical about it and we're on our devices and telling our kids to get off their iPads, just like the stories earlier, I don't think it works. I think starting with us, if we were to say as a family, what should you start with? We would say the first place is, why don't you start with device-free dinners? Family meals are so important. They have so many beautiful benefits to kids' development. And so it doesn't require a gourmet meal, but just getting off of your devices together and having a conversation.
Tracy Foster, it's been great having you.
Thank you.
And Ian Schur, author of Your Kids Hate Your Smartphone Addiction, thank you, and you can check your phone now.
Thanks.
Speaking of phones, the clock on your phone's going to reset itself this daylight savings. Your internal clock will not. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we always have a circadian rhythm. It always governs our own internal sense of what time it is and what our bodies should be doing at any given moment. But daylight savings has a way of making us more aware of that internal clock, because suddenly it does not match the external clock. So with daylight savings creeping up on us this weekend, we're going to find out everything there is to know about circadian rhythm. How does it even work? We have an expert who can tell us. Jeffrey Price is a biologist at UMKC. He studies fruit flies, and he was connected with Nobel Prize-winning research on circadian rhythms. Jeffrey Price, good morning.
Hi.
How would you define circadian rhythm?
Well, they're essentially rhythms that are driven by an internal endogenous clock. So under typical light dark cycles, we do things at certain times of day. We tend to sleep at night, be awake during the day. But if you put an organism under constant conditions where you take away environmental cycles, the behavioral cycles continue. And they're not exactly 24 hours, so they're not driven by some sort of cryptic cue associated with the Earth's rotation. Instead, they come from within the organism. So that was the focus of my research, to try to figure out what genes and proteins inside the organism produce the circadian rhythms.
Yeah, like our circadian rhythms come from us, not some like star out in the universe.
Right.
But you know, I've been reading up on this, and please correct me if I get this wrong, but according to the National Institutes of Health, the master control, if you will, like that mm-hmm. circadian rhythm represents, comes from a bundle of neurons in our brain with direct input from our eyes and therefore sunlight.
Mm-hmm. So the clock runs a little bit slower or faster than 24 hours, and that means that there has to be a daily input from the light cycles or even the temperature cycles in fruit flies, and to readjust it to 24 hours. And of course, when you travel halfway around the world, you have to completely reset your clock. So there does need to be photic inputs.
So wait, the length of our day is 24 hours and our circadian rhythm is not quite that. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying, yes.
That's messed up.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a lot of the problems that come with time changes then come from a temporary misalignment of your internal clock with the new cycle you're forced to adapt to.
Okay, so here is a thing that is confusing to me. Circadian rhythm is what gives us the feeling that we should sleep when it's night and we should wake up in the daytime. Mm-hmm. Why aren't babies born knowing that? Newborns wake up and go to sleep at totally random
times.
Right,
right. So their clocks are not completely functional when they're first born. It takes a while to really consolidate the rhythms. The whole neurological output doesn't work very well when they're first born. So they sleep in short periods and then they wake up. So in addition to the clock, there's a homeostatic mechanism.
What does that mean?
It means that we get tired the longer we're awake. And so what the clock does is force us to stay awake during the day, even as we're getting more tired. And then finally
why does the clock do that to us? That seems cruel.
Well, because, you know, think about how could we be human if we couldn't stay awake for 8 hours at a time? There are organisms that sleep every couple of hours. But, you know, human culture would not exist if we had that kind of a sleep-wake behavior. So we make up, you know, when we sleep overnight, we make up the deficit that we accrue during the day.
Sleep is the thing most people do associate with circadian rhythm. What else does it affect that we might not think about?
A large number of things. So hormonal secretions, body temperature, alertness, athletic prowess, all those
athletic
things.
Athletic prowess?
Yeah.
Tell me more.
So, you know, most athletes do better later in the day than they do early in the morning because for whatever reason, our ability to do things athletically improves over the course of the day.
Weird. And what about body temperature?
So body temperature goes up and down. I work on fruit flies, which don't change in temperature. I don't remember exactly what the phase is, but it does show a clear, 24-hour change of about a degree or so.
And so this brings me to you do study fruit flies to learn about all of this. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
So fruit flies are an excellent genetic model system. It's just much easier to do things in fruit flies. You know, they have a 10-day, after the egg is laid, it takes about 10 days for the adults to come out. And so you can go through generations very quickly. You can analyze large numbers of them cheaply.
Why is an entire generation an important thing to have access to when you're studying something like circadian rhythm, which is, it sounds like, about a 24-hour cycle?
So we normally monitor them for about a week to measure their rhythms. So it's not measuring the rhythms per se, but it's doing the genetic crosses that you need to do to screen for mutants. So that usually takes a couple of generations. And the faster you can do it, the faster you can get results. It's very cheap to raise flies. If you're doing a screen with mice, it gets very, very expensive to look at large numbers of individuals. So flies are relatively easy to screen. And that's why most of the early mutants that identified the mechanism were identified first in flies. And I should say, in addition to circadian rhythms, researchers have moved into sleep in flies. So in the biology program, we recently hired another faculty member by the name of Stefan Dissel, who works on sleep. And that has a circadian element to it, but as I mentioned, it's not all circadian. He works on the neural pathways that control sleep and the homeostatic mechanism. And so it's very easy to study that in flies also.
But do flies have enough in common with us that you can make a direct correlation? I mean, I understand that every living organism has a circadian rhythm, and that sounds not fascinating. But when you think about it, like a single cellular organism, like a virus would have a circadian rhythm in that case?
No, not really. Not every organism
has
a circadian rhythm. There are certain single-celled organisms like cyanobacteria, photosynthetic bacteria, have rhythms. Yeast do not, although they have metabolic rhythms. So not every organism has a rhythm, but a large number do, and most multicellular organisms have rhythms.
So,
and we don't know. Yeah, a priori, we didn't know that the fly rhythm was the same. It just turned out to be the case.
What can we learn from what? Have there been any surprises in your research with flies that have illuminated something about, like, the human condition as relates to the circadian rhythm?
Well, I don't know if I would say there have been surprises, but there have been overlaps. So the factors that regulate the rhythm in flies are basically the same in humans. There's a transcription factor that moves into the nucleus and turns on expression of two of the key genes, period and timeless. And likewise, period is regulated by the equivalent human proteins. So, and then those proteins, period, and timeless build up, move into the nucleus, and shut off their own transcription or synthesis. And a similar feedback loop exists in humans. So,
and I want to just say, I'm not a science expert, but what I do understand about what you were saying right now is that these are all functions that are smaller than a cell.
Yes.
And that is crazy that something at the less than cellular level is making me tired,
right,
or making me warm, or making me better at sports.
So that was probably I think you've just raised the biggest surprise that came from the work, which is the clock is an intracellular mechanism. In the early days, people thought you would need a complicated nervous system to have a circadian rhythms. And then, you know, we figured out that they exist in bacteria, fibroblasts from your skin. Each cell has its own circadian rhythm. So that was really probably the biggest surprise for the field, that single cells can produce, have biological clocks.
So we're talking about circadian rhythm with scientist Jeffrey Price with us from UMKC. And Jeffrey, we're talking about this because of daylight savings. How does daylight savings affect us biologically?
Well, I actually had to do a little bit of reading because I don't normally consider this in my work. But it turns out that the transition from standard time to daylight savings time is really the most damaging, because you lose an hour of sleep during that transition. So immediately afterwards, there are more traffic accidents. People are tired, right? So there are more traffic accidents, more heart attacks, more workplace accidents on Monday right after the transition, and more miscarriages after in vitro fertilizations. But all those effects are very transient. You know, it's you rapidly adapt to the new phase. So it's not really a long-term change. And for the current transition that's coming up, we're actually going to get an hour of extra sleep on Sunday. So that's
good. Unless you have a small child.
Right. But, you know, that's sort of going to be true no matter what the time is for the small child.
Jeffrey Price, thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
And now, before we go, a few questions about sleep from a sleep specialist, because you might need it this weekend. I know I will. Dr. Jason Graff, Medical Director for Sleep Disorders for the St. Luke's Health System. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Do you see a lot more people coming in with issues around sleep when daylight savings has happened recently, one way or the other, fall back, spring forward?
I do see some of that, again, mostly in the spring, because people lose an hour of sleep. And if you have a sleep disorder and you're already sleep deprived in some sense, you may be able to tolerate that less. But typically a shift in about an hour, most individuals compensate to that pretty quickly. Especially in the fall, when you're basically getting an extra hour of sleep, of course, unless you have little kids.
Or unless your issue is that you tend to wake up before the alarm clock goes off.
Right.
So what can people do to keep their sleep patterns as stable as possible around daylight savings? Any tips or tricks?
Well, you know, if you're a master of your own environment and you don't have kids, they're going to wake you up early, you have the ability to control your schedule. You know, some people around daylight savings, you know, in the fall, like if your body is used to going to bed at 10 o'clock and that's when your circadian clock, your internal rhythm makes you sleepy normally, and you normally get up at 6 a.m. and then all of a sudden the time falls back and you're going to find yourself getting a little bit more tired at 9 p.m. You can adjust to that in the fall by being more active in the evenings for a little bit, maybe exposing yourself to a little bit of bright light in the evenings when you get sleepy. That suppresses your brain's normal rise in melatonin. Blue light or sunlight. Sunlight's probably the best, but blue light, the kind of light that your handheld device emits, can actually help you accustom to being less sleepy in the evenings. But that's, as we talked about earlier, in the earlier segment, it's probably more likely to cause insomnia.
Yeah, because same reason.
Correct. So you can overdo it and create the opposite problem that you're trying to correct. In the springtime, when you're going to lose an extra hour of sleep, being sleep deprived by an hour can increase your risk of car accidents. Data has shown that. Those folks can try to go to bed a little bit earlier to try to make up for that on the night before the clock springs forward. But often it's difficult to just spontaneously go to bed earlier if you're not sleep deprived going into it, if that makes sense.
So stepping back, I mean, do you see things when you're out and about during waking hours around daylight savings? Because we've heard that the data shows that there are higher incidents of all kinds of accidents right after daylight savings. But do you, as someone who's really like attuned to all the ways that sleep affects us, see things out and about in the world this time of year that you think correspond to sleep disruptions, subtler things than accidents?
Not as much in the fall when it comes to transiently getting a little bit more sleep. I see it more acutely in the springtime, where people might be a little bit sleep deprived because of the loss of an extra hour. Again, that's really transient. In the fall, with rainier days, shorter days, less sunlight, I tend to see more problems with mood or seasonal affective disorder. You see that a lot more in places in the Arctic, like Alaska, where they have cycles where the days are very short and it can be quite dark for extended periods of time. That can have negative effects on your circadian rhythm, as was previously stated, with regards to your exposure to sunlight, kind of reorienting your internal body clock to your environmental cues and your a more stable 24-hour cycle.
So when you talk about seasonal affective disorder in the fall more broadly, does sleep come into that?
It can. I mean, people may get a little bit more sleep when the sun isn't shining in your window at 5 o'clock in the morning, but it kind of depends on the individual. Most of the time in the fall, having the clock shift by an hour does not negatively affect most people to a significant degree. And if you've ever traveled across one time zone, typically jet lag is not a significant problem. You can sort of correlate that time shift with what would be expected if you just traveled across one time zone.
I'm going to tell you something right now. I mean, you're making it sound like this is all no big whoop, but that is not what it really feels like to me.
It is not a big deal. If you allow yourself enough time to sleep, your body will compensate through its own circadian rhythm to when you get exposed to sunlight and when you put down your iPad at night and when you eat your meals. And within a few days, a normal person will compensate to that. You may feel a little bit tired at work. Yeah, I mean, if you're abnormal, if you already have insomnia, any of these clock shifts can exacerbate the condition. I have patients call during those times and they have a little bit worse sleep, but it tends to be transient. And in fact, a lot of times when I talk to some of my patients with insomnia who are affected by this, often they're worry and overreaction to the time change creates greater problems than the actual physiology of the time change, if that makes sense.
You know, it does. When you talk about being in control of your own sleep, that is actually, I mean, I would say that's not a condition that could be considered like the assumption. I mean, whether it's that, as we've mentioned, a small child who doesn't know how to tell time and will wake up when their body tells them to, no matter what daylight savings is doing, or whether it's a work schedule that makes you not the master of your own wake up, go to sleep kind of times. Those things, yeah, does that affect how dramatically people are affected by something like daylight savings?
It can. I mean, all of those external things, you know, the text message you get right when you're trying to get in bed, or answering work emails before bed that upset you so you can't fall asleep very quickly. Family emergencies, job changes, shift work is a big problem. All of that makes people feel that their sleep becomes less of a priority. And a point I want to make is that you have to make your sleep a priority. You have to plan ahead for it, get rid of the things that would make it worse, and be consistent with that. And your own circadian biology and your own circadian rhythm will take care of the rest.
Well, thank you so, so much. It's been great talking to you. And Dr. Jason Graff, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Jason joined us from St. Luke's, and you can listen to anything that we had on today's show at kcur.org/Central Standard. We spoke about cell phone addiction earlier in the show, which kind of corresponds to not being able to go to sleep. That's kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow is our November arts show on Central Standard, and we will be talking to Jason Sudeikis, so tune in for that tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, and Suzanne Hogan, as well as intern Sophia Gillespie. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.